the almond tree blossoms, the grasshopper trails, as berries of caper, the strong desire fails. So man goes away to his long-lasting space, as mourners surround in the street every place. That was verse 5 of chapter 12 of Ecclesiastes, the Word Green version, the last part of chapter 5 of chapter 12, verse 5, the last part of verse 5 in chapter 12 of Ecclesiastes from the Word Green version of 2004, our daily scripture for today, little ones. And now we have the final paragraph in our article, The Ark of Urartu, The Orient Express. We've just looked at the modern-day reconstruction of a ziggurat, such as the ones that were found in the land of Mesopotamia or Babylon, in that area of the land between the two rivers, which was Babylon and Babylonia, and where these empires of the Sumerians and later on the Babylonians were located. Kainan, in paragraph 12 now of chapter 2, our final paragraph, is identified as Nana, the moon god, based upon the Nan, N-A-N, ending of his name alone. So we're ignoring the C-A-I part, where Kainan, C-A-I-N-A-N, is reduced in Arabic to J-N-N, which means hidden, like the genie, for example. It's reduced to jinn. So the fascinating thing about Arabic is it allows the softening of the hard G sound. And I'm not even certain, but it's even... I'm wondering if, in fact, the soft J sound can be also pronounced with a hard G sound in some cases. Because I was so astonished at what I learned from the Arabic that it was difficult to remember precisely what it was. So I don't. But there's some kind of equality between J and G. That's what it is. Some kind of equality, which was never clear in the English language. It was never clear at all. I mean, there was a hard G sound and there was a soft G sound, but the J was always soft. The J sound in English. So there seemed to be no relation between the G and the J. But from the Arabic, we see there is a relation between, for example, even in this case, J and C, and C is connected to G also. In translating between different languages, C and G are sometimes interchanged. So this connects the J to the G sound, and also to the C sound, to the hard G sound as well as the hard C sound. Well, of course, in Turkish, which is another language, in that language, the Turkish, we saw that C-U-D-I is pronounced Judy, so the C is pronounced with a J sound, like a soft G, as in the jinn, this J-N-N, and in Fushi, which has the meaning of, we saw before, something like hidden in the name Fushi. There are many mysteries to discover within languages. So if I look for this word, yeah, Fu means, I think it means low-lying, doesn't it? What do we find out about Fu? Low-lying, or... Let's look up the word low. Fu means low-lying, right, in Chinese. And just like Kainan is low-land, So there seemed to be a relation between Fushi and Kainan, even though Kainan is a different word from Kainan. It's similar enough. Certainly the consonants are identical, and usually all the meaning is contained in the consonants, although that wasn't true in the case of the two names Kainan and Canaan. In the Hebrew, they meant different things, but we see there's a lot of meaning and a lot of things to be learned from the details of the language, right? So that's what we're talking about here. Now we're in chapter 2, paragraph 12. Let's go back to that and continue from where we left off. So the JNN, right, in the name Kainan, if the CNN can be equated to JNN, is like the JNN in Jin and in Fushi, the hidden meaning, that is, the meaning of to be hidden, is contained in those names, Jin and in Fushi. Since Nana, okay, is also called Sin, or Suen, like there's Naram Sin or Naram Suen, he was one of the Akkadian kings who ruled during the dynasty of Sargon of Akkad, right? In that dynasty, he was the grandson, we believe, of Sargon II. And he was called Naram Sin. So even in his days, this name had still been preserved, the name Sin, or Suen. And the moon, and that's the moon god, Sin, or Suen. And there is a similarity to Shinar, or Senar. And as there existed in Shinar, because Shinar is simply the same as Sinar, without, if you take out the H, it's Sinar. And Shinar is also similar to China. We noticed that. It's very similar. Shinar without the R is China, which is like China. And after Kainan's day, in Shinar, there existed a long tradition of observing the heavens in order to make predictions. We know that in the Book of Jubilees, Kainan is mentioned as having made, I think it was the Book of Jubilees I'm thinking of. Yeah, I'm pretty sure, actually, but you know, I'm trusting my memory on that. Kainan made astronomical observations, or he found writings about astronomical, that's what it was, found writings that contained observations of the heavens. So, and then in the land of Shinar after his day, there was a long tradition. In Babylonia, for example, they kept records, even in the dynasty of Sargon of Akkad, much previous to the Babylonians, they kept records. There was a book called The Observations of Bel, which was published ostensibly by Sargon the First, or during that dynasty anyway. And a long tradition of observing the heavens there was in that region of the world near Babylon there, where they had these ziggurats and where they worshipped the heavens. And they did that in order to make predictions, which was a sin in God's eyes. It was a sign, right? They'd see the heavens, the way the heavenly bodies moved was a sign to them. They could make predictions based on how the moon or the stars or the other planets or the sun moved. And these predictions were a sin, but they were also a sign. In other words, they took it as a sign. The heavenly bodies were intended from Genesis 1:14 to be used to keep track of the seasons, right? But not to be used to predict the future or something like that, not to be used for prediction. So it was a sign to them, but it was also, by definition, this word sin is also pronounced sign or seen as a sign. In the way it's spelled, it spells sign if you pronounce it as a long I, and it's the same as in the name Shinar without the H. It's just the land where they looked at signs in the heavens, Shinar. And it is not very surprising that Kainan himself might have become, because of this, the god Nanna, whose father is called Enlil. Enlil is Lord of the Wind, whereas the name of Arpakshad, the father of Kainan, means in Hebrew, healer or releaser. Compare that with the healing or releasing power of breath, breathing. The healing or releasing power of breathing. For example, when we relax, we breathe deeply and evenly and so on, and this is known to be an indicator of health, right, of how we're feeling, certainly, you know, of our inclinations and so on, our ability to breathe well, for example, you know, to breathe in a relaxed way is important to our health. And this Enlil is said to have invented the mattock. He was called the Lord of the Wind, as we said, but he invented the mattock. And Shennong, who we identify as Shelah, the son of Kainan, means in Chinese a divine farmer. He was the son, Shelah was, of Kainan, right? Yeah, so he was a grandson of Arpakshad, and his name means divine farmer, Shennong, in Chinese. So this would correspond with this, the idea of Enlil inventing the mattock. And then his grandson being a divine farmer. The land of Shinar was a very fertile area, so cultivated. The father of Arpakshad and Enlil was Shem, called in China Yu Chao, meaning there exists a nest, or home builder, home builder. After the deluge, we might imagine that home building was a top priority, so that Shem, meaning name, the name Shem means name, so it's interesting, isn't it? Because his very name means name. The name Shem, and it also brings up another point that came to my mind, is the idea of shame. When you bring reproach upon your family name, or when you bring, you know, shame upon your family, then you're bringing the shame upon the name of your family. So the name Shem also has the meaning of the shame word, the word to pronounce it as a longer, with a different vowel, a long A, shame. It's also something you bring upon your name in that case. But the name Shem means shame. I mean, the name Shem does not mean shame. The name Shem means name. So it could also mean shame if you bring shame upon your name. But he was a builder, evidently, because after the deluge they would have to build houses or some place to live. Shinar was occupied in the days of Nimrod around 2800 BC. That's the date we give to these times of the Tower of Babel and the very beginning of Shinar, right? This is the very beginning. And that was around 2700 and something. It was after, we think, slightly after 2800 BCE in the century of 2800 to 2700. That's where we date Nimrod. The Sinaitic language is the Chinese branch of the Sino-Tibetan. And Sino-Tibetan derives its name from the moon god Sin from Shinar. Curiously, again, so Chinese is a branch of that. Or I should say, no. Chinese is not a branch of that. Chinese is the main branch. The Sinaitic language is the Chinese branch of Sino-Tibetan. See, we'd have to study this a lot more to get more information about the languages here, but the Sinaitic language derives its name from the moon god Sin from Shinar. Tibet derives its name from a root similar to Tiba. And Tiba and Tibet, therefore, come from this word, it looks like, meaning ark, the word Tiba. A root similar to Tiba, which means ark. So Tibet and Tiba are from a similar root. And Tiba means ark, the ark of Noah's ark. So that's fascinating that Tibet would have a meaning associated to Noah's ark, isn't it? And Kainan lived until the Yellow Emperor. Evidently, Heber, his grandson, ruled China beginning in 2699 BCE in the Chinese mythology, dates that we gave in a previous table, which was the beginning of the rule of the Yellow Emperor, Heber. Which agrees amazingly with the other evidence. It's just so in agreement chronologically that it's not that we know exactly when any of these things happened, but we do have the remarkable reality that we don't see any contradictions really in the information. So it agrees with the other evidence, proceeding now to the three sons of Noah. We honor this king speaking about the Yellow Emperor, I believe is the one whom we honor in this limerick. There once was a ruler named Kainar who took up his dwelling in Chinar. His message was sent, so he got up and went, leaving great-grandson Peleg in Shinar. Limericks are a sort of poem that are five lines, and they rhyme in the first, second, and fifth, as well as in the third, rhyming with the fourth, like that, with the rhythmical structure in the same way that was given here in this example also. So that's a limerick. And there once was a ruler named Kainar who took up his dwelling in Chinar. His message was sent, so he got up and went, leaving great-grandson Peleg in Shinar. That's a little explanation of what happened to cause the separation of the Yellow Emperor from the rest of his family. We don't really have any more evidence, that is more definitive than what we've shown, although we're going to see whatever evidence we find in the rest of this article. Hopefully, soon, we'll be studying it and continuing our study. But that was a very remarkable or refreshing study of the Chinese history, was it not? And it enabled us to connect somehow the Bible with the people of China, which has never been done before, as far as I know. It's never been done in the way that it was done in this article, and I've never seen it done that way, at least. But it was refreshing because there's enough correspondence to give some tangible insight or, significant insight. So let's continue now with our study of the raw expedition, shall we, if we can do that now, if that's all working here. Let's see what we can do. This is part two of the raw expeditions of Thor Heyerdahl. Let me just, first of all, let's shrink this down. There we go. Okay.
Although we were immensely pleased with our speed, we soon had another serious problem to worry about. Ra 2 started sinking much faster than Ra 1. Our new ship seemed to be too small for the many tons of cargo she carried. The heavy load pressed us deeper and deeper into the water. While we clipped ourselves fast with lifelines so as not to fall overboard ourselves, we started to throw away anything not desperately needed. Our papyrus lifeboat went first. Santiago, our quartermaster like last time, went carefully through his inventory to find anything we could dump. Help. The sinking stopped. We continued our voyage in the direction of distant America, due west.
They are still in the coastal shipping lanes. After dark, their tiny paraffin lamps are hard to see from busy modern ships. The night watch plays his flashlight against their sail, hopefully to give a better warning. After 2 days and nights of excellent sailing, they suddenly come to a stop. They are becalmed. And they still have an enormous distance to go to America, most of which they have covered the year before.
As we woke up the third morning, the wind had died away. Our sail was no longer filled, and we found ourselves drifting helplessly to and fro without any visible progress. To film ourselves from the outside, we had a small rubber dinghy with room for two or three men. In the calm water, it was easy to observe small black clots of solidified oil. We had discovered the previous year endless quantities of oil lamps drifting about in the Atlantic Ocean, and the samples we delivered to the United Nations then caused such wide interest that we decided this time to undertake a systematic daily investigation. The lamps were black and soft like tar or asphalt. We saw them every day, and sometimes they carried passengers of various kinds. In this case, a tiny crab. Day after day, no wind, no progress, only slow sinking on the same spot. To keep spirits high, even a university professor is willing to turn clown. Mexico and Egypt on the stage.
As they drift aimlessly in the current between the Canary Islands and the coast of the Sahara, birds of many kinds fly by and frequently settle on board. They're fed and cared for, and Ra, too, begins to look like a floating aviary. Even a whale joins them, but is not close enough to have a decent portrait taken.
Okay. That's the end of part 2-2 of the Ra expeditions. We should stop there for today. So they had a slightly smaller boat, or significantly smaller boat, for the second attempt at crossing the Atlantic here, using the trade winds again and the currents. So it's interesting that that we can learn something from voyagers like that, people who journey across the ocean using the power of the wind alone, and the currents, of course, of the ocean currents. But the winds are so useful if they're prevailing in a certain direction. They can be used to travel. And as we go north in the Atlantic, the winds prevail in the opposite direction, I believe. So they go toward the east, and therefore you could cross the Atlantic in the northern Atlantic in the other direction. So it is conceivable, using just the trade winds, that ancient peoples could have crossed the great oceans, as was proven earlier by Thor Heyerdahl when he crossed the Pacific, for example, from South America to Polynesia in the Kon-Tiki expedition. So that's interesting. He sounded like, I wasn't sure if he said they were slowly sinking when they were. His accent makes it difficult to understand what he's exactly saying, it seems to me. Whether he said they were slowly just sinking. I think they stopped sinking once. I thought they had stopped sinking. That's why I was puzzled by that. I thought they'd stopped sinking once they'd thrown enough things overboard. But It's quite interesting that they didn't do any testing or any, you know, they didn't do any vessel testing. They just set out on this journey and then found out they were sinking. They didn't do a lot of preparation, did they? So that's it for today's, I mean, it's fascinating. It's not necessarily the recommended way to do things, but they were very practical and they weren't very theoretical or experimental. So, yeah, we talked about how they could have perhaps prevented the breaking of their steering oars on the previous expedition if they had known just to make it thicker in the direction of the force. So whatever direction a force is acting in, if you thicken the object in that direction, it will prevent breakage in that direction. So whether if it's a sideways force, then you want to make sure you thicken it in the sideways direction, so it can't bend in that direction of the force, in other words, as easily. So it can't break. And there are ways and means, you know, of designing things and preventing things from breaking. So I want to talk a little bit about Amazon now. Amazon's done a phenomenal job in so many different aspects of everything. Basically, in delivering things, the great. How do I do that? Let's see. Wait a minute. Oh, it's this way. Yeah. Yeah. Amazon does a great job delivering things. They do a remarkable job. And you know, if you want to, even you can return. You can return items, and I don't like to return things. I don't think that's a good idea. That's why I do a lot of careful shopping before I make a purchase. So I bought this leather jacket, just received it today, and I was quite surprised, you know, by it. It wasn't exactly what I was expecting, but it's bigger than I thought. It doesn't look, I mean, it's got genuine leather. They say it's made of real leather, genuine lambskin. But when I first saw it, I wasn't convinced of that either. I didn't didn't look like or seem like genuine leather either. But I think I'm going to trust because of the price and how many people buy it, and it's a best-selling item and all these things. I'm going to believe that it's what they say it is. It's a little bit too large, but then I remembered, well, I can't send it. I just don't like sending things back anyway. So I always commit to what I'm buying, and then I don't send it back because I've committed to it. So I've made my commitment, and I stand or fall based on what I decided to buy. You know, I don't believe in trying to get my money back, basically, for anything. So I tried to... Oh, I want to talk about my burn. Okay. But anyway, the jacket, I got it a little bit bigger so that it would, if I wanted to wear some warmer clothing underneath it, it would still fit me. And it actually, the sleeves are a little bit long, but it's better too long than too short, I think. So actually, it's actually just about perfect. Now, the zipper doesn't, the first few times it hasn't been easy to zip it up or to get the zipper started, but hopefully that will improve. I think the last time I tried it was easier, but so I think it's a beautiful looking jacket. It just looks beautiful. And it's hard to tell if it's real leather because you can't see the back of it. It's all beautifully stitched with polyester lining, and it's a beautiful lining, high quality, very high quality polyester silk lining. So it's beautiful. So I really, but everything that I've got some new Chicago screws of different colors from different materials, that is, you know, from Amazon too recently. And I got some dress belts, which are extremely good in their pricing. Really good and really nice. But I burned my finger, right? I told you that. And then I put ice on it. And I realized just when I took the bandage off the other day that I should not have put ice on it, because when I read the literature, ice is what you don't want to do with a burn. So now I've got this dead spot on my finger where it's like a callus where there's no fingerprint or you know, it's, I don't know, it's like there's no there's not much sensation there. Hopefully that's going to return. It might heal, it might get better. And of course, you know, if it were really bad, if the skin died, I might need a skin graft or something, you know. I mean, if the worst case, right? If it were a bad enough burn and a bad enough freezing with a ice pack. So ice pack injury is real. You don't want to use ice when you're treating a burn. You can run it under cold water, but not ice cold water, for, you know, say 20 minutes. But what I should have done and didn't do was I should have wrapped it up sooner, because that prevents the pain when you get it out of the air. I should have put my, perhaps even my vitamin E cream, should have put the vitamin E cream right on it. I didn't use that because I forgot about that. But anyway, and then I should have wrapped it to prevent the air from making it hurt. But I didn't do any of that. So the vitamin E cream can speed the healing. And I should have. Now I will, from now on, try that. And I'll always wrap a burn quickly after cooling it down with not cold or not too cold water, but cool water. I'll wrap it quickly. That reduces the pain a lot, and it allows it to heal better. So we're at the end of our study. September 26th, 2024, of the Common Era. The time is 1936 hours, North American Eastern Daylight Time. I'm Ward Green. I love you very much. Thank you for listening and watching, and in my behalf, this is Liv Dusty, and this is Cassie, saying bye for now. That's the end of Chapter 2. Of the article, The Ark of Urartu, The Orient Express.